The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Capital Thinking. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to talk about some things that are impacting college campuses nationwide. We're going to take a look at a Supreme Court ruling this week on the extent of the EPA's power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And we're going to talk about an international trade case and the implications it has in the legal world. We start with college campuses today, and our guests, Susan DeMickley and Amy Davenport from Squire Patton Boggs. Susan is a partner in the Squire Patton Boggs Columbus office, where she's the co-leader of the firm's labor and employment practice. Amy Davenport's public policy specialist in the Washington, D.C. office of Squire Patton Boggs. And they're here to talk about the Department of Education, President Obama, and the United States Congress as they examine Title IX and sexual assault and sexual discrimination on college campuses nationwide. So, Susan, welcome to you and your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. Let's start a little bit with your perspective on what colleges and universities are doing in relation to Title IX, sexual assault and abuse. We know the Department of Education has been very busy earlier this spring releasing a guidance document with frequently asked questions that schools have about their legal obligations to prevent and respond to sexual assault. So maybe give us the big picture perspective on what's going on and how college campuses are changing their policies as they increase awareness of this issue.
Yeah, well, thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here. And you're right. There's been a lot of talk about this lately. The lawyers are busy, and that's a good thing for you and I. But for colleges and universities, I think this is really a confusing time and a bit frustrating as well. We all agree that the right thing to do is to prevent and to stop sexual assault on campus. And we don't have a lack of guidance out there. At this point, the lawyers are really sorting through a lot of the white papers that place a lot of this squarely in the lap of universities and colleges across America, a societal issue that we do need to address. But in answer to your specific question, what's going on right now, I think that most colleges and universities are dusting off their policies. There are some new guidelines that have been released that you've mentioned. There are also amendments to the Clery Act that went into effect earlier today, and this fall will have new reporting requirements. And so there are a host of new requirements that are placed on colleges and universities that now need to kind of go through their policies and make sure they are, in fact, in compliance.
Very good. Well, let's talk a little more about that. Obviously, schools are seeing all these things shift, and they're wondering how to adapt. So what kind of advice are you giving them for how to update their Title IX policies?
Yeah, well, the advice we're giving, first and foremost, is standing still is not an option. You know, we recognize that the guidance is not as clear as we would like. But that being said, waiting until things become clear is not the option that we're advising. What we're advising is take a step back. There are some things that we can do. We can develop a checklist. We can, or you can work with your counsel to develop a toolkit to see, okay, do my policies have some of the basic requirements that we know DOL and OCR and others are saying are best practices. And so there's that piece of it. But then there's also just the training and education piece. You know, summer is a good time when things tend to be a little quieter to think about, you know, ramping up this fall. What are we doing or what aren't we doing that we should be doing in working with our faculty, with our students, with our staff to make sure we've got best practices out there? And so we're having a lot of those discussions this summer as we gear up for, you know, a new season in the fall.
Yeah, so Amy, let me shift to you and talk about what's going on in the halls of Congress. You've got Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri that's sort of been spearheading the sexual assault issue, both in regards to the military and now sexual assault on college campuses. And I know she's got some plans to do some things legislatively on Title IX. She's had a bunch of meetings. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about the meetings that she's had on this topic in Congress and what you think is likely to come out of it related to Title IX?
Absolutely. So over the past month or so, Senator McCaskill and a number of other lawmakers have been hosting roundtables to talk about sexual assault policies on campus, talk about the Clery Act, the Campus Save Act. These are the laws that require colleges and universities to report on sexual assault cases that they're handling on campus. And through these roundtables, Senator McCaskill has said that she's just trying to learn what's going on campus in order to formulate her thoughts and her legislation that she's planning to introduce. We've heard that it's likely that this legislation is going to be introduced after the August recess, so probably September timeframe. And right now, there's actually a bipartisan group of lawmakers that are working on this legislation. Senator McCaskill said she's open to including this in the Higher Education Act reauthorization bill, but since most folks believe that that's unlikely to actually pass this year, they're also talking about moving the bill on its own, and they believe that they have the support to do that. But to get into some of the specifics of what the bill might include, Senator McCaskill has said that she is really interested in looking at stronger penalties for colleges that violate the rules on reporting and handling sexual assault cases. And she's also mentioned that she's considering including a requirement in the bill that would impose consistent penalties for students that are found responsible for sexual assault. Right now, there's inconsistent policies across college campuses, but Senator McCaskill is looking at possibly including things like the loss of federal financial aid or having a permanent notation on a student's transcript that would be a consistent policy for all universities to use. She's also interested in looking at increasing the mandatory training requirements for campus staff that are investigating sexual assault crimes, but has also said that she really wants to be careful not to add additional regulations, additional reporting requirements, because a lot of the reporting requirements that colleges and universities already must comply with are burdensome in the eyes of many schools.
Interesting. Well, I know one of the things Senator McCaskill has done is send out a survey to about more than 400 institutions asking them for how they deal with these things. And I know there's been some concern at the institutional level that filling out those forms and eventually having that information released publicly, in addition to what's out there on the Clery Act, opens them up some potential liability from the plaintiff's bar in the future. Susan, I want to come back to you and say, related to that, Department of Ed earlier this spring put out a list of 55 colleges and universities that have Title IX violation investigations pending. This is not something they've done before, and while they say it was done in the interest of transparency, it sure looks like it was done as a way to pressure those schools and to raise visibility about this. So talk to me about what it means to be on that list as an institution and how it changes how a university might react to this issue.
Yeah, and look, Kevin, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, there is increased awareness in part because of that list, and while certainly the list was put out there to increase vigilance and to try to draw attention to the issue, I think that what we're seeing is a bit of a chilling effect and, you know, a list that is requiring those on it to act defensively instead of proactively, and that certainly isn't what we want. You know, we've got to solve this issue together, and it's more than a checklist. But certainly, I don't think that that's going to stop. I think we're going to see this list continue. Last I heard, there were about 60 on the list, and I think that, you know, look, the White House just put out its first report on this issue in April, and so they're looking to continue to draw attention and to show that they're doing something about it. And as we see, you know, elections this fall, I think the issue will further ramp up. It's constantly in the press. Not only are the lawyers busy, but we've got students and faculty taking positions on various issues like the standard of evidence that should be used at the local level at internal judiciary proceedings, like the rights of not only the victims but the accused. We've seen men, frankly, continue to bring lawsuits over issues of rights regarding the accused. And so, you know, there are so many complex legal issues that are coming to a head. And, you know, this list, while I think the intentions were perhaps good, what it's doing is it's in part taking away from some of the real issues that we want to get to regarding training and education and putting best practices in place rather than, you know, operating under fear or duress.
So, Amy, let me come back to you on the McCaskill survey because you work with some universities as well. Do you think that their participation in filling out this survey is something they're very wary about and how it could be used against them going forward?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as Susan was mentioning, there's definitely a chilling effect to some extent until colleges and universities can kind of bring their sexual assault policies into current present day. There is some concern about actually, you know, sharing those procedures with senators and with the federal government. But I think one turn of events that was really interesting, the American Council on Education actually held a webinar for its member universities that provided guidance to them on how to respond to Senator McCaskill's survey. And Senator McCaskill was, needless to say, was not happy with this webinar and wrote a pretty strongly worded letter expressing her concern that schools would be less likely to reply as a result of this webinar. Despite the fact that I do think there probably were some schools that may have been a little wary of responding due to the ACEs webinar or maybe even just, you know, before the webinar went through, I think that Senator McCaskill probably got enough responses from schools that were willing to participate to really get an understanding of what the current climate is. I think, you know, as we've discussed with the Department of Education's releases a list of schools under investigation for Title IX violations, I think schools are starting to realize that this is a really important issue and that they're going to need to be engaged on it and really thinking about how they're going to be able to comply with Title IX and other laws related to campus safety and sexual assault.
Susan, let me ask you to give folks your email address if they have a desire to get more information from you.
Yeah, absolutely, Kevin. It's Susan, S-U-S-A-N, .DeMichael, D-I-M-I-C-K-E-L-E, @squirepb.com.
And Amy, the same for you.
Absolutely. It's Amy.Davenport, D-A-V-E-N-P-O-R-T, @squirepb.com.
All right, Susan DeMichael, Amy Davenport from Squire Patton Boggs talking about the Title IX debate in the halls of Congress and on college campuses today. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back in just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit about a decision out of the Supreme Court that impacts greenhouse gas emission rules here in the United States. Keep it here for more Capital Thinking.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than five decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, it's the last of June, which means the Supreme Court is busy cranking out major decisions that impact us in our everyday lives. And on to talk with us about one of the decisions that's just come out is Doug McWilliams, a partner in the Squire Patton Boggs Cleveland office, where he works on environmental counseling, emphasis on air permitting, enforcement, and administrative procedure. Doug, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. And maybe tell us about this case that came out from the Supreme Court Monday dealing with the Utility Air Regulatory Group and their battle with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me. Yes, this case dates back to the 2007 Supreme Court case, Massachusetts versus EPA, when the court opened the door to greenhouse gas regulation. But that decision addressed only whether greenhouse gases could fit within the overall scope of the Clean Air Act. Ever since, EPA's been struggling with the specifics over how to regulate greenhouse gases within the major source programs, given that Congress drafted this without having any knowledge that climate change would ultimately be an issue. So the Utility Air Regulatory Group case addresses two Clean Air Act programs that apply to the major stationary sources like utilities and factories. There's an operating permit program under Title V of the Act, and then the Prevention of Significant Deterioration program, which we'll call PSD, that regulates large sources that are newly constructed or modified in a way that significantly increases air emissions. The court reviewed EPA's attempt to solve a dilemma in the statute applied to greenhouse gases. See, Congress established numeric limits, annual numbers of tons per year, that these two programs would use as thresholds to ensure that only the largest sources with sufficient resources to be subject to the burdensome federal permitting programs.
However, when these annual thresholds are applied to greenhouse gases, smaller sources became subject to these burdens, certainly more than what Congress had originally intended when they set up these programs. So EPA tried to solve this dilemma by significantly changing the statutory thresholds, by taking a 250-ton per year limit for PSD and changing that to 100,000 tons as it applied to greenhouse gases. This was EPA's tailoring rule. And the Supreme Court in this Utility Air Regulatory Group decision determined that EPA could not make those statutory modifications it believed were necessary and reverse those portions of the case.
So, Doug, I know that EPA has a lot of ongoing permitting programs, a lot of permits already given out or under consideration. How does this Supreme Court ruling have a practical effect on those programs and maybe what's pending or what's already been handed out?
Yeah, there's a significant practical effect for the two permitting programs, although it may be primarily for a narrow band of sources. The court decided that EPA did not have the obligation or discretion to bring new sources into these programs solely on the basis of their greenhouse gas emissions. So the primary beneficiaries from this decision will be sewage treatment plants, certain mining activities, sources combusting biogas or biomass, where their primary emission is greenhouse gases, that they're not emitting conventional pollutants and major source amounts that would subject them to the PSD and Title V permit programs anyway. So many of the changes that EPA has implemented over the past several years for stationary sources will need to be revisited to carve out those sources that the court has determined do not belong and that EPA doesn't have the discretion to include in these major source programs. But the court didn't stop there. You know, the court determined that the court also had to examine whether EPA had the authority to include greenhouse gases in the control technology determinations for these sources that are caught by the Title V and PSD programs anyway. So sources for which conventional pollutants are large enough to expose them to PSD permitting, the court had to determine if EPA had the discretion to require the best available control technology for these greenhouse gases. And in fact, the court determined that the statute did not prohibit EPA from applying back to the best available control technology for greenhouse gases for these sources that are in the programs anyway. So that portion of the tailoring rule that was subject to review remain in place. So EPA will have to go back and pull out those portions of their rule that have been eliminated while retaining those that have been supported by the court's decision.
So what's the broader significance of this ruling?
Well, we talked about a little bit about the significance for that narrow set of sources that are not subject to, that will not be subject to PSD or Title V permits because their sole trigger would be greenhouse gases. But there's some broader themes here. I mean, the court clearly is attacking EPA's exercise of statutory reconstruction, that if EPA is going to address greenhouse gases, they have to do, under the Clean Air Act, they're going to have to do that within the confines of the statute. EPA cannot determine that the greenhouse gases regulation results in absurd results and then read the statute to solve that problem. So certainly the court is telling EPA that they have to do, that they have to stay within the bounds. But EPA is also provided by this decision significant discretion within the confines of the statute. And the backed portion of this decision is a good example of that. What Justice Scalia determined, writing for the majority, is that the agency is not prohibited by statute from applying control technology to greenhouse gases. And while the majority identified a number of restrictions and how that could be applied, the court did stop short of directing EPA as to how BACT would be applied.
So, Doug, I know that from what I've read about the case, there will eventually be other big issues around the Clean Air Act that, pardon the pun, you're going to have to clean up as a result of this case. Can you talk a little more about those?
Sure. One of the significant issues that the court left unresolved is what will be the threshold for these anyway sources in applying the best available control technology to greenhouse gases. The court identified that there's an implicit de minimis threshold below which these BACT determinations will not be necessary or required, even for sources subject to PSD anyway. That de minimis threshold still needs to be established. EPA in the tailoring rule had set 75,000 tons as an initial significance threshold for greenhouse gases. The court decision does not disturb that, but EPA also made clear that in establishing 75,000 tons, they were not setting a de minimis threshold. They reserved the ability to set a different level for de minimis purposes. So EPA is going to have to go back and work on where they set that threshold for triggering control technology for greenhouse gases.
Very good. And obviously, the Supreme Court took a very middle ground, incremental approach in many regards to this case. Is there anything else about the positioning that they came to this case with that you think impacts the future that people should be thinking about?
Yes, it's been interesting to see the press. All sides in this case are claiming victory, and the court has really set it up so that that could happen. The direction to EPA is that they must work within statutory limits. But as Justice Roberts made clear and spent particular time focused on, that EPA had predicted in their rule that 83% of the carbon emissions regulated under their tailoring rule would still be regulated by applying best available control technology to these anyway sources. So the vast majority of the benefits that EPA had hoped to garner from the tailoring rule are still in place by applying best available control technology to major sources triggering PSD anyway. The smaller subset, about 3%, will be eliminated here. And those are sources that are significantly emitting greenhouse gas emissions but aren't emitting other pollutants. And so EPA will have to, is restricted from using the major source programs of Title V and PSD to regulate those sources under this decision. I think the majority took some comfort in the idea that they could limit EPA's authority, particularly with Justice Scalia writing this opinion, that the statutory limits were necessary, and the court identified and emphasized that EPA must live within those statutory limits. On the other hand, they gave EPA the majority of the authority and discretion to regulate the greenhouse gases that they determined were the primary reason for this tailoring rule.
Doug, hit folks with your email address so they can get more information if they're interested.
Oh, sure. It's douglas.mcwilliams@squirepb.com.
Very good. All right, we're going to turn our attention to the international trade world when we come back after this commercial break here on Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than five decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
All right, happy Thursday to everyone, and welcome to a very special edition of Capital Thinking. We're going to spend some time talking about political issues, but we're going to focus our first segment on some of the major legal news of 2014, and that is the merger between Squire Sanders and Patton.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the international trade world today with Richard Oprell. Richard's a partner in the Squire Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office. He specializes in International Trade Commission investigations under Section 337 of the law. We're going to talk a little bit about the investigative procedure in some of those cases. So, Richard, welcome back to the show. Delighted to have you with us. And tell us a little bit about what a Section 337 investigation actually is and how it all works.
Thanks, Kevin. Good afternoon. The International Trade Commission is a very interesting agency, the ITC. It deals with a variety of international trade matters, but one area that it deals with is what's called Section 337 investigations. And for a 337 investigation, the ITC has the authority to investigate claims of patent, trademark, or copyright infringement, along with other types of unfair competition, such as stealing trade secrets, that can occur when someone imports or tries to import into the United States a product that that is infringing on somebody's intellectual property rights. And once the ITC initiates an investigation, it can't award money damages, but it does have the ability to enter an exclusion order, which can preclude companies from importing products into the United States. And there is a
wide, a fairly wide range of authority for the ITC. It can decide to, if it finds that a product is infringing a patent, for example, it can find that a specific company's product is infringing and exclude just that company's product. It's called a limited exclusion order. Or it can find that a whole category of companies' products are infringing and exclude all of those products, no matter who is making them or who is importing them. It's a very powerful tool that owners of intellectual property can use to enforce their patent rights. And you can use it in connection with ongoing district court litigation. So you could have an ITC, a complaint that you file, and at the same time file a case in federal district court for patent infringement, look to get your money damages in federal court, and look to get your exclusion order or injunctive kind of relief from the ITC.
So tell us a little bit about how these investigations actually get started, Richard.
Sure. They are started when someone brings a complaint to the commission, and it's a complaint, unlike in federal court, a complaint before the ITC has to be very detailed with specific facts and evidence. So it requires the petitioner who is bringing the complaint to do a whole lot of work up front in order to get the complaint on file. Now, once you file a complaint, the ITC, the full commission, has to decide whether or not to institute the investigation. In most instances, when a complaint is filed, the investigation is instituted by the ITC. One reason is because of a fairly unique procedure that the commission uses, and that is a petitioner who's thinking about filing can draft a complaint, provide it to the ITC staff, the Office of Unfair Import Investigation, which advises the commission, and the staff will actually sit down and meet with the petitioner and say, this complaint we believe the commission will accept and institute, or we believe it won't for the following reasons, or you're missing critical evidence that we think you need to have. So once the complaint is actually filed with the ITC, the staff has a pretty good idea that they are going to recommend to the commission that the case be instituted.
All right, and then what are the next steps from there?
Sure. Once you file the complaint, the commission takes about 30 days to decide whether or not to institute the investigation. Once it does that, these investigations, compared to district court litigation, move very quickly. They're typically resolved within about 16 months. There is an administrative law judge who conducts the proceedings in the initial instance. There is discovery, but it's on very short deadlines. So sometimes when you're involved in one of these proceedings and you need additional time to respond to a discovery request, you're often not looking for days, but literally hours as an extension. So they move very quickly. The administrative law judge conducts a trial, an evidentiary hearing. He or she then makes an initial recommendation to the commission on whether or not the unfair competition case has been proven. It then goes to the full commission for its review, and it can either affirm the ALJ's decision, reverse it, or take some kind of middle ground. Then once the commission itself makes a decision, it then goes to the president, acting through the U.S. Trade Representative's office, who can either accept or essentially veto the ITC's decision. In almost all instances, the president accepts the decision. There's one
One example where they did not fairly recently was when there was a decision by the ITC in favor of Samsung against Apple, and Apple was able to persuade the president not to agree with that exclusion order and actually reverse it. And from there, the entire matter can be reviewed by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Again, it sounds like a lengthy procedure, but it's really very fast and can be very powerful for someone who's looking to enforce their IP rights.
All right, so tell me, the complainants, what do they have to prove to actually prevail in this type of proceeding?
Sure, it's a... there are several statutory criteria under Section 337. They first have to show that the product or products at issue are actually infringing the patents or the intellectual property rights. There you can defend and say a patent or a trademark or whatever is invalid, and that would get tried by the ITC. But you also have to show that there is a domestic industry component if you're the petitioner. So you have to be engaged in the business and selling your own product in the United States. Or you have to show that you are licensing your intellectual property rights to others that are acting in the United States. So it's meant as a way to protect domestic industry from unfair importations. And you do have to, even though you're not entitled to money damages, you still have to prove some kind of injury to that domestic industry, like lost sales or profits or lost customers. So there are several things that you have to prove. It's a real trial-like setting, evidentiary hearing, and you have to prove it by preponderance of the evidence. So it's a fairly high standard. But it's one in which more and more companies are taking advantage of because it's harder to get an injunction in federal district court because of a Supreme Court case a few years ago called the eBay decision. And it's harder to get an injunction in federal district court. But if you can go to the ITC and get an exclusion order, you certainly are not only protecting your IP rights, but it's also giving you a fairly high degree of leverage to either to settle a dispute and keep someone out, or to settle on favorable licensing terms.
Gotcha. Well, Richard, give everyone your email address in case they want to follow up for more info.
Sure, it's richard.operil, O-P-A-R-I-L, at squirepb.com.
Great. Well, that's going to do it for this segment on Section 337 investigations. Hold on. After this commercial break, we'll talk about the rights of the Washington Redskins in the trademark world with the challenges to the heritage of that team name. Keep it here for more on Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, happy Thursday to everyone, and welcome to a very special edition of Capital Thinking. We're going to spend some time talking about political issues, but we're going to focus our first segment on some of the major legal news of 2014, and that is the merger between Squire Sanders and Patton Boggs, creating this week Squire Patton Boggs. Joining us, Jim Mayworm, the chair and global CEO of Squire Patton Boggs with law practice. Jim focuses on a diverse range of businesses, international and domestic acquisitions and financing. Also joining us is one of the global managing partners of the new firm, Steve Mann. Steve is in Cincinnati. His practice focuses on mergers and acquisitions and private equity. So, Jim, let me turn to you and say welcome to Capital Thinking. You were one of the quarterbacks of this merger. Talk to us about the strategic reasons behind what is the largest law firm merger in the world in 2014.
Well, thanks, Kevin, and I'm glad to do that. We had lots of different prongs to our strategic thinking on the part of both firms when we were thinking about whether putting these firms would make sense. For what Squire Sanders brought to the table that was of interest to Patton Boggs is a superb global platform. We have very strong positions throughout the United States, throughout Europe, throughout the Asia-Pacific region. And Squire Sanders is strong in transactional work, disputes, and regulatory, which is also obviously becoming a bigger and bigger element of what businesses are dealing with both here in the United States and across the world. So Squire Sanders brought a very healthy, strong, broad platform. But we were very interested in the strengths that Patton Boggs had. And what Patton Boggs brought to the table from a Squire Sanders standpoint was, of course, the premier public policy and lobbying practice in Washington, D.C., which we think is going to grow and become even more important to our clients as they try to anticipate problems coming up in the regulatory regimes rather than waiting until after problems are besetting them. Also, Patton Boggs brings a lot more than just a lobbying practice, a very strong white-collar investigations practice, for example, was a key element of interest. Patton Boggs also had strong litigation and transactional practices, litigation representing parties from the United States in the United States and also representing parties in the United States who came from outside the country. Lots of experience in terms of cross-border disputes and cross-border transactions. There's also very interesting geographical positions that Patton Boggs added to the Squire Sanders platform. Not only does Patton Boggs have a very strong Washington, D.C. position, but also very interesting and ideal positions in New York City, Dallas, Texas, Denver, Colorado, and then, of course, in the Middle East. Squire Sanders historically has been active in Riyadh and Saudi Arabia, but in contrast, Patton Boggs has been active not only in Riyadh, but in Doha, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi as well. So a very strong regional position that can take advantage of the strengths of Squire Sanders historically in places like Europe and Asia Pacific. So there were multiple strategic prongs for this, very important to both firms, and the firms really fit together very nicely because each firm brought things that were of critical strategic interest to the other. And what we're doing here, Kevin, is we're building a law firm that enables our partners to better serve clients more fully, interactively, proactively, and with a lot of sophistication. So we're very pleased. Lots of reasons why this combination made sense, and that's why the partners of both firms approved it overwhelmingly.
So, Steve, that's a good transition. Your title, Global Managing Partner, in terms of clients and strategy. Talk to us a little bit about where you want to grow Squire Patton Boggs in terms of its legal practices.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. This is a pleasure. Again, great week for Squire Patton Boggs. Really excited to be coming together with a spectacular Patton Boggs firm from the legacy Squire Sanders perspective. And I think first and foremost, we'll want to be known as a full-service global law firm with an unparalleled footprint. As Jim mentioned, we're going to be in 44 markets now in 21 countries, the largest offices of which are in Washington, D.C. and in London. In terms of a strategic focus on practices, Jim rattled off a number of those, but just to reiterate, obviously the historical Patton Boggs public policy practice with global preeminence. Our public finance and infrastructure practices complement each other incredibly well. On the regulatory side, we hit virtually every regulatory branch and agency within the U.S. government and extend that reach abroad with our footprint throughout Europe, Asia, and Latin America. On the dispute side, we have really four or five different areas of preeminence, typical big case commercial litigation here in the States. We have among the finest joint practices in international arbitration abroad. We also, as Jim mentioned, have really the preeminent combined white-collar defense practice. On the M&A and capital markets side, likewise, very, very complementary fits and probably the most complete global offering there. Jim mentioned the government practice and sovereign wealth investing and institutional investing in general is a strength that Patton Boggs brings to the combined firm that just augments what we've always had as a strong funds practice on the U.S. side, particularly in the legacy Squire Sanders sense. And so all of that just rounds out what are our core practice areas, such as environmental, healthcare, labor and employment, tax, real estate, et cetera. So together, just incredibly excited about coming together with the two firms.
So, Jim, let me come back to you. You talked a little bit about the expanded international presence in the first question that I asked you. One of the things that really strikes me as dynamic about this combination is that it's the confluence of capital and capitals. The new firm is in 20 national capitals around the globe, and in basically every capital, every major city where capital formation and capital flows is a major source of legal business. So talk to us about how that expanded international presence, what that's going to mean for the strategy for the new firm.
Well, we're going to continue to follow a strategy that we've been following, and what we have now is the benefit of additional strengths coming out of Patton Boggs. Our global operation strategy, Kevin, is relatively straightforward. We have been striving, and I think we're pretty much there, of being in the key commercial hubs around the world. You want to be in places where, as you say, capital flows, where transactions happen, where disputes are resolved. And you want to be able to say to your clients, if you have a problem or an opportunity anywhere in the world, we want to be positioned in the key commercial hubs that will enable us to help you with that problem, with that dispute, with that opportunity. And together, these firms really do have a almost unrivaled platform around the world that enables us to do that. The other element of the game plan in terms of global operations is to be intensely collaborative. And one of the things that we were very comfortable with as we began to talk with Patton Boggs from the legacy Squire Sanders side is that Patton Boggs also had a culture of working together collaboratively, getting the best people in the position to help clients either resolve problems or deal with opportunities. So in key commercial hubs, be intensely collaborative, have very good people, and watch for regulatory and other developments that clients need to be aware of so that we can warn them in advance of problems that are arising, help them resolve those problems in advance, or if necessary, deal with various regulatory regimes. So that's in a nutshell, that's the strategy. We want to be where the clients need us with the people that make sense and take advantage of both the opportunities and problem-solving skills that we've got.
Steve, Jim mentioned culture, and from your perspective as a global managing partner, talk a little bit about the unique history Squire Sanders, a 100-year-old firm, very storied in American history and who they've represented over decades. Patton Boggs, 50 years building a very unique practice focused around the nation's capital. How do you take the best of two outstanding law firms, their history and culture, and put them together and emerge with something better down the line?
Kevin, it's a great question. So if you ask our clients what they value in their decisions as they make legal services decisions, they're most typically driven off of the relationships that they have with our people on both sides. And so we sort of took that same approach to our combination discussions and sat back and decided among ourselves, are these the kind of folks on both sides that we want to practice with and spend material parts of our lives with? The answer continuously and consistently kept coming back, yes. Culturally on both sides, we value that collaboration that Jim mentioned. And honestly, if you look at our the way our practices come together, increasingly this our global world will be more regulated and our business connections will be more global. So all of the intersection points of regulation and a global footprint made the proposition a clear one on both sides.
So, Jim, we've talked a little bit about the past. Talk to us about the present and the future, maybe some of the metrics about how large a footprint Squire Patton Boggs has in comparison to other law firms, and your view of the changing landscape of law firm operations and what it means for clients and better service in the future.
Well, thanks, Kevin. The law firm on a combined basis will be one of the top 10 law firms in the world in terms of global presence. And in terms of size, we'll be among the top 20 in terms of number of lawyers. But the key thing, as I said earlier, was that not only do you have people in lots of places, but you're in key commercial hubs with the right kinds of people who can help clients with the types of issues that arise in those jurisdictions. So we've got a platform that's really second to none, and people who are very good and who will work together to solve client problems. As you look at what's going on in the landscape of the legal practice, you're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years a continuation of trends that have been affecting the industry and our clients for the past decade. And what are those? Well, one is globalization. And our response to globalization of business is to build an unrivaled global platform, as I said earlier, that is in these key commercial hubs with the right kinds of people at the right times. A second major trend is, of course, increasing regulation. And that's regulation that is increasing not just in the United States, but around the world, and also increasingly regulation and schemes of regulation that apply across borders. And one of the goals of our combination with Patton Boggs is to enable our combined firm to be even better than either of the legacy firms was in being able to respond to these complicated, complex, important cross-border regulatory schemes that will affect clients very greatly on an ongoing basis.
Very good. Well, we've been joined by Jim Mayworm, the global chairman of Squire Patton Boggs, Steve Mann, one of the global CEOs in charge of clients and strategy. If you want to learn more information about the new Squire Patton Boggs, you can hit us at squirepattonboggs.com right here on Capital Thinking.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.